Good to be back with you, and weather kept at bay for us for the week. But I always hate having to do that. So I'm glad we can meet again together today. Just on a personal note, want to express my thanks to many of you. As you know, my big brother died this last week. His health has been iffy for a while, yet it wasn't expected. They were planning on him checking out of the hospital. He has these recurring infections in his legs. He has a ton of metal in his legs from a work injury years ago. He also was in Vietnam. He had Agent Orange exposure and all kinds of things that were always bucket against him, and just didn't wake up this past week. So I don't know when and for how long I'll be gone when the memorial is. His daughter's planning everything, and he's being cremated. So there's time and opportunity. And so at some point, I'm expecting to either go to Washington or California or Las Vegas. It just depends on where my siblings decide they want to do this. So it's an opportunity for me as well of in my family of the now eight of us. Well, Mark had made a profession of faith when I saw him. I said, "What's your opinion of Jesus?" He said, "I follow him." So I said, "Works for me." My other sister is a believer, and then that's it out of us. So appreciate you keep praying for them as they deal with that. We've had some actually kind of fun conversations. Mark was kind of a hoot to live with, and his jokes were awful, but that made them all the funnier as well. So again, just thank you on behalf of the entire Okowski clan. And we're going to get into another psalm today, Psalm 31. And I want to ask you a question. Do you ever think it's okay to tell God what to do? Well, there's kind of an obvious answer. It's like, no, we don't do that. Well, what if I showed you some passages, and they'll be in this psalm, where David is telling God what to do? Oh, what's he doing? How is he getting away with that? We're going to look at, as I said, Psalm 31. We're going to, at some point, read all 24 verses. So some of it we're going to condense down a little bit. But let me give you a little bit of background with David and also Saul and what's going on that he's writing this psalm. He is calling out to God in what's often called a complaint, where he's going to express what's happening to him. He's not going to mince any words. He's getting persecuted by King Saul. So again, you look back at the timeline in 1 and 2 Samuel. And by the way, the Hebrew Bible doesn't have 1 and 2 Samuel. They have it all in one book. All right, but for someone down the road, when they started putting chapter and verse division, said, "Let's make this into two books." It's the same material; it's just how it's divided is all that matters. So, but there are themes also in that book of Samuel. But for the history, Saul was the first king. The people went to Samuel the prophet, says, "We want a king. We want a king." And so God said, "Give him a king. Anoint a king," and that's what the word Messiah actually means, is to anoint someone for a leadership. And this was not necessarily wrong. There were some motive issues going on at the point, because God told them in Deuteronomy 17, when you get into the land and you want a king, here's how you have a king. So he tells them how to do it. And then they pick Saul. Saul's from the tribe of Benjamin, and to be honest, Saul starts off pretty well. He is trusting the Lord. He has great victories, some battles. He's doing a great job. But then he starts to have some problems about chapter 13, 14, and 15 of 1 Samuel. And as a younger man, I wanted to deal with that very issue. Why does Saul lose the kingdom? Because God will say, we're done with you as king. And then they anoint David in the very next chapter, chapter 16 of 1 Samuel. Why was Saul, why did he lose the kingdom? And David did some pretty bad things too. What's going on? Well, what's happening is, and again, this is the overall context of David's story and Saul's story and the context of how he's writing this psalm. As you read through the book, you see several themes. One of them is that God is deliverer. And the best example of that is when David takes on Goliath. You know, is there no deliverer in Israel? You know, he's personifying this wonderful idea that God is deliverer. And then there's also the theme of, I call ask of God. In fact, the name Samuel means asked of God. That's what his mother asked for a son, and God gave her a son. And so Samuel means asked of God. Well, you see again, multiple times where David is asking God, should I go fight these people? Should I do this? What should I do? And it's an act of faith. It's an act of submission. Saul, later on, is actually asking a pagan witch what to do, which is a bad example of that theme. And so we actually see both bad examples and good examples. But there's one other theme, and it's called honor for honor. And because God says, those who honor me, I will honor, and those who don't, I won't, kind of thing. And so you see Saul not bringing honor to the Lord later on, but David does. It's all about the Lord for David. Now, again, as the history continues, God says, we're done with Saul, but he's not physically removed from the throne. He's still serving in that role, but they've anointed David, a little shepherd boy, likely a teenager in chapter 16. And then you have chapter 17, which is the whole David and Goliath story. And then David ends up joining Saul's, entourage, or he's part of his soldiers. He is a mighty man of valor. And we see one victory after another, and just he's getting the job done. He's making Saul look good. But then people start saying, wow, David's pretty cool. Saul's cool, but David's really cool. That's when Saul, frankly, starts to go a little nuts. He's losing his mind. He persecutes David literally. He throws a javelin at him, he's after David. David is fleeing for his life. And he's living now in the land, living off the land. He can't go to public places because Saul will find him. So he's hiding out in the wilderness, living off the land. And then, to make it even a little bit harder for him, you know, it's one thing to take care of yourself. But then a bunch of guys start joining David, up to like several hundred. So not only is he trying to keep himself hidden, he has to keep this little mini army hidden and provide for him and get food. And God's using this to train him in his leadership and so forth. But Saul's chasing him all over the country, back and forth. Multiple times David has opportunities to kill Saul, but he won't do it because that's taking deliverance himself. God, and he says, look, God put him on the throne. God has to remove him from the throne. So you see this very heart of David. Saul ended up not following those examples well. He failed over and over and over again to trust God for deliverer, to ask God, to honor God. David, on the other hand, although not 100% perfect, did a much better job at that. And that's why when we talk about this expression, the man after God's own heart, think of it this way. Saul was the choice after the people's heart. They picked him. David is the choice after God's heart. The heart we're talking about, really grammatically, is not the heart of David. It really refers to the heart of God. God picked him. just kind of a little different way for us to see that. But this is a psalm of deliverance. It's going to point out that while David is being chased around the wilderness by Saul, he's going to pen these words. And as we read this, you go, well, that's a really great psalm, but I've never had a crazy king chase me in the wilderness, throwing javelins at me. Does this apply to me? Well, think of it this way. Have you ever had people who opposed you, who were against you? I've been in positions, I've had opportunities where I could not do a single thing right. I could have cast rainbows and someone would, the enemies, the people against me would find some reason to criticize. And it was bitter. It was awful. The number of times I wanted to quit in those times. It's like you could do nothing right to be persecuted in that way. So while they were not physically shooting arrows or javelins at me, it was a time where they were making my life miserable. So let's jump in to David's statement of rescue, or really describing how he's being hunted by this guy Saul. Psalm 31, 1 through 5. He says, "In you, O Lord, O Yahweh, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress save me. For you are my rock and my fortress. For your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. You take me out of the net they have hidden for me, for you are my refuge. Into your hands I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God." We'll get into the telling God what to do in a minute, because I don't know if you heard it in that passage. But first of all, David uses some words about God. He says he's a refuge. He calls him a refuge in verse 1 and 2 and 4. What's interesting is it's the same word in the Hebrew Bible in verse 2 and 4, but it's a different word in verse 1. But the 2 and 4 word is ma'az. It means a place of safety. It could be a literal place of safety, like a harbor or a mountain. But figuratively, yet very truly, it's used as God. God, you are my refuge. And it's very commonly used in the Old Testament in that way. Psalm 52, Isaiah 17 and 27, Nehemiah 8, and scores of other passages where God is the refuge. Spurgeon says, "For David, the Lord was his only refuge." The other word, similar, is fortress. And that's in verses 2 and 3. Hebrew, the word is masuda, and it means fastness or stronghold. It could also mean castle. And so think of like a literal fortress that you can hide behind and be saved. One commentary said that God himself was the stronghold in whom David trusted throughout his trials. And then the other word we see repeated in that verse, in those five verses, is the word rock, and that's used in verses 2 and 3. Now, if you remember, way back in on May 14th, 2023, who remembers? We did a series called The Names of God. Now who remembers the names of God? Okay, we did that. One of the names of God is rock, and that word is zur, Z-U-R, in English, zur. And like fortress, it can be used as a literal word rock. So there's a rock. There's a zur right there. But in a poetic, yet again, very true sense, when it says God is a rock, it means he's something that we can count on. It's not going to break apart. It's not going to move. And so we see these three words, refuge, fortress, and rock, that just have this idea of solidness. Again, Psalm 32, for example, when we did that message, and if you want to go back, you could probably find it on our website, May 14th, we looked at Psalm 32, where over and over and over again, Moses calls God the rock. He is also a repeated idea here. He redeems, he delivers, and he rescues. And we saw that multiple times. So David's initial statement, he says, look, I take refuge in the Lord. And he likely is remembering the previous deliverances. Look back in his life. Before he took on Goliath, they say, you're just a kid. You're just a little squirt. And David says, I've defeated bears and lions. I mean, this is no different. And then maybe he's remembering Goliath. Maybe he's remembering the battles that he's gone out and fought, even as a young man, where God had transformed him into a mighty man of valor. But he's not relying on himself. He's not relying on his skill. He says very clearly, in your righteousness, deliver me. God, by you, literally save me. God saves according to his righteousness. And that is true for really our salvation. It's not according to how good we are. It's not good at how we follow the rules or if we're better than that other person. God saves according to his righteousness, his very character. Now, what are these commands? How can David say these things? And I'm going to say commands, but let's put some air quotes around them. Because it's not like David's in charge, he's putting himself in God's place. But he's calling upon the Lord to act on his behalf. Some things he says in that paragraph that we read, let me not be put to shame. In other words, I want other people to see that you are delivering me. And that's his other command, deliver me. And then he uses kind of a churchy word, incline your ear. I think the only time we ever use incline is either we're in Pittsburgh or we're in church. Just means, God, listen to me. Listen to me. Rescue me, another command. Be my rock, be my refuge, lead me, guide me. Now, these so-called commands make sense to someone who trusts in the Lord. Sum it all up, he's saying, God, be God. Yahweh, be my Yahweh, be my Elohim. Be the one who's going to rescue me from these things. Now, maybe you also heard a familiar phrase. As we read verse, I think it was verse 5, there is a familiar verse that Jesus said on the cross. He said, into your hand I commit my spirit. Did you catch that? Jesus said that as his last words. I mean, seconds later he was dead after saying those words. And this is the real messianic Jesus part of this whole psalm. Now, here's what I find very interesting. So if I say, go to Isaiah 20, verse 4, you would flip in your Bible, find Isaiah 20 and verse 4. That's how we look up verses. The trouble with that system, now it's very handy, but the trouble with that system is we tend to take those passages out of context. And so I encourage you, whenever you're told to look at a verse, look at the verses around it to get a better idea of the context. This is extra. I'm going to charge you for this. But it's kind of a Bible study method to look around the context. I'll tell you once, it was for like Easter or Christmas or something like that. We got some posters, and there was a quote regarding Jesus, and we looked it up, and it's in the Bible, but Satan was speaking. It's like, okay, we're not going to use that poster. Got to look at what's going on in these passages. So, but they didn't do that in Jesus' day. The numbering system that we have, they didn't have. Now, there are some of them they did. Like they knew there were, you know, the Psalms were like separate chapters like we do and so forth. But they didn't have that numbering system. Remember, they had scrolls, so they'd have to unroll them. We see Jesus doing this in the synagogue. He would unroll the scroll, find the spot he wanted, and read from it. What they did, instead of looking at, you know, referring to a specific verse, is they very often quoted part of a verse or a section, but they refer to the bigger context. Do you follow me? So while Jesus said those words, he's not just thinking of those words alone. He's thinking about the whole psalm. And I know it's a little dogmatic. How do you know what he was thinking? I'm just telling you how people normally refer to the scriptures then. So when he says, "Into your hands I commit my spirit," that's absolutely true. By the way, Stephen the martyr said that in Acts 7. But he's most likely, or very well could be, thinking of this whole psalm, the bigger context. And so it's a psalm of deliverance. So now there's Jesus on the cross, and he's saying, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." He's not just saying, "Well, I'm saved." He's saying, "God can deliver me even from death. I might be dying, but for God, he can even deliver me from death." It's a very, very strong statement of faith by Jesus himself by quoting that psalm. Let's go back to Psalm 31. A few more verses. Look what's happening to David. "I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord." Jonah quotes this in his, what I call his fishy prayer. "I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love, because you've seen my affliction. You have known the distress of my soul, and you have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. You've set my feet in a broad place." So he describes these enemies. They worship worthless idols. They're godless. And David didn't like them because they didn't like God. And in contrast, David trusts the Lord instead of these idols. So we see that in his life. But yet they are causing him real grief and sorrow and wasting. Now, from a New Testament sense, we say we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. And we don't. That's not the real enemy. But flesh and blood can hurt us still. They can persecute. Literally, Spurgeon says that these enemies, they were pleased to have something to throw at me. And they're scheming and they're plotting. Now, this psalm's a little bit different in some of other David's, I guess we would say, complaint psalms. In that most of the time, he says, "God, here's the problem. Here's what I'm dealing with." And then there's a kind of a change in the psalm where he expresses his faith, his thanksgiving, his hope in the Lord. And they end on a real positive note. This psalm does that, but twice. He's expressing his grief and his faith, and then he'll do it again. We'll get back to that later. Statement of reliance, verses 9 to 17. This is where the second outcry starts, right about verse 11. "Be gracious to me, O my Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief, my soul and my body also." You feel the tension he's facing. "My life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity and my bones waste away. Because of my adversaries," here's the complaining more, "I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, an object of dread to my acquaintances." He's being gossiped about. He's being maligned. He's being slandered. "Those who see me on the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I've become like a broken vessel, for I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme against me, as they plot to take my life." Now, statement of confidence. "But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Make your face shine upon your servant. Save me in your steadfast love." If you remember before, when ESV uses that word steadfast love, that's hesed. That is the mercy of God. "O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go to Sheol." So, and we, of course, see the similarities between Jesus' sufferings and David's. Jesus is actually led to death. And it's how the world views Jesus overall, even today. He is an enemy. You want to tick off certain people? You want to get arrested in certain countries? Say Jesus. They hate him. They hate his guts. And so he understands that. For David and for Jesus, their hope remains in the Lord despite the circumstances. Now, God knew what was going on. I mean, do you think God was in heaven going, oh, wow, David, I'm sorry, I was doing something else. But yeah, well, he knew everything that was already going on. It was, in a way, cathartic and helpful for David to be able to express those. We may not, as I said, maybe you are, I don't think so, but maybe we're facing pressures or attacks of another nature. Maybe we're getting attacked from pressure from the world. Maybe people think we're weird. Maybe we're trying to do all the right things and we're getting criticized for it. We have spiritual enemies. We have the enemy of our own sin. We have the enemy of death. We have the enemy of the world and the devil himself. These are enemies too. But David makes a statement. He says, You, Yahweh, I trust in you, O Yahweh. You are my God, my Elohim. Yahweh is my God. By name. David was not a fair-weather believer, as Spurgeon says. And then he gives even more commands. Again, rescue me, make your face shine upon me. Save me according to, again, your steadfast love. Let me not be put to shame. Let the wicked be put to shame. And he says a statement that's a little vague for us to understand. He says, let them go to Sheol. And that can mean a couple different things. Sometimes the Old Testament uses that word just to mean death, die. It could also mean their view or their perception of hell. Is David saying, let them go to hell? Now you think, that sounds mean. David can't make that call, and you would be right. David's not making that call. He's saying, God, you take care of the vengeance for me. I'm going to trust you not only as my deliverer, I'm going to trust you to vindicate me. Vindicate me. And that might mean the death of someone. That might mean even their conversion. Final, now he gets right back to this confidence again. And we'll finish off the psalm here in verses 18 to 24. Let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is your goodness, God's goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you and work for those who take refuge in you, in the sight of the children of mankind. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. I mean, this means words. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his, there it is again, steadfast love to me when I was in a besieged city. I said in my alarm, I'm cut off from your sight. But you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried for your help. Do you see his just utter dependence? No matter what's going on, he's looking at the Lord. And finally, he has this statement for whoever's reading this, which is us as well, making this proclamation. Look, y'all, love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. We see these descriptions of God, how he has abundant goodness for those who fear him. He hides his children from the plots of men and stores them in his shelter. He wonderfully does this because of his chesed, his mercy. And he hears when he thinks he can't or doesn't. If you've ever prayed and wonder if God's listening, it might not feel like he is, but don't go by your feelings. He hears. He hears. He summarizes the attitude in adversity and attack. Love God. He preserves you. Remember, he repays the arrogant. One commentary, Kylan Dillich, says, pride is the sin of sins. God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And be strong in him. Take courage when you're waiting on the Lord. As you're getting attacked, as you're being verbally or literally or figuratively being chased around the wilderness by crazy people, put your trust in the Lord. Now, will that automatically, bing, make everything nice and beautiful? Will he change your circumstances? Maybe. But maybe not. David was in the wilderness for years running from Saul. So what does this mean for us? Well, first of all, I have a theory about why there's two sets of cries and statements of confidence instead of just one, like most of his psalms of a similar vein. And I'm basing it kind of on my own experience, because there are times when we've come upon something difficult or a trial or been verbally persecuted or attacked, and you think, okay, I'm putting my hope in the Lord. Well, you know what might happen a few days or weeks later? That starts to get a little thin. And maybe I need to do it again. And I'm wondering if that's what happened. My theory is maybe that's what happened to David. He was doing really well. Started to doubt, started to kind of need to remind himself a second time. What do we do when our confident faith starts to slip? Go back to the beginning. Go back to the beginning. Remember Elijah on Mount Carmel? I think it's the most frightening story in the Old Testament, if I was Elijah. And that's the story where I get his whole nation, the nation of Israel and Judah, they were running away from God. They were worshiping idols. They were throwing their children live into fires. And so Elijah calls them all together. It was Elijah and 400 other dudes that were pagan, idolater, worship priests. He says, look, let's both make an altar. You call on your God, and I'll call on Yahweh. And they spend all day till they're hoarse, and no fire, nothing comes. No one hears them. In fact, Elijah starts to taunt them and literally says, where's your God? Is he in the bathroom? And they're cutting themselves and doing all these pagan rituals. Nothing. So Elijah says, get a bunch of water and just douse this. I can't remember how many times. It's like, what, seven times? Seven times they douse this dead bull on this altar. I mean, it must have just looked gross, just dripping with water. And here's the scary part. Because Elijah prays and says, now, God, now. And this fire, all the water, I mean, just imagine the explosion, the smell, the sound of sizzling water and everything. What a moment of victory. That's gutsy to say, I'm going to ask God to send fire at that moment, and he does. In the next chapter, Elijah's running from Queen Jezebel. He just called down fire. But now Jezebel threatens him, and he loses it. Because, folks, sometimes our faith wanes. Then come back. Remind yourself again of who the Lord is. Come back to him. You don't have to live in that. And the other question for us is we have to ask and be honest with ourselves is, who is our rock? Who is our fortress? There are good things for which we rely upon. Family and friends, our jobs, our wisdom, our training, even our reputation. Those aren't necessarily bad, but are they our fortress? Some of those things are gifts from the Lord. But none of them are rocks like he is our rock. He will never change. He will never fail. Because he's our rock, let me challenge you to command him. Command him to be who he is in your life. The other thing we can apply here is to view our enemies. Yes, they are real. As I said earlier, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but flesh and blood can hurt us. We have to let God take care of vengeance and vindication. And this is very much a New Testament concept. Read Romans 12, like the last third of that chapter. And there's a whole description about giving blessing instead of retribution. It's not easy. But vindication and judgment and vengeance are very much in God's job description. He will take care of it. He will bring that in his time when he wants it. Sometimes he will bring that enemy over to you. One of the people that was very, very difficult for me, again, in an earlier position, ended up being, is now to this day, one of my closest friends. In fact, she flew all the way out here to be at my daughter's wedding from California. But you know what? I was on the other side once. When I was in high school, and I became a believer right about in the middle of my high school career. Before that, there was a guy, he was a classmate, same grade I was. His name was Lowell. He was a bold believer. He would speak up. He would share the gospel at the drop of a hat. I mean, he spoke his mind. He wasn't rude. He wasn't hitting people over the heads with the Bible. He just spoke truth in a gentle and wonderful way. And we teased him mercilessly. And we called him names and made fun of him and for his beliefs. And I was one of them. And I was one of those guys. Then God came in and changed my heart. And it was maybe about a year or so after that, just God gently told me, you know what? You need to ask Lowell for his forgiveness. I said, you're right. And I went to Lowell and said, Lowell, you're right all that time. And please forgive me for all the things that I said and did and made your life hard. And he said, it was okay. And we had nothing in between us. And I appreciated that. But you know what he got? Vindication. He was right all along. He was right all along about the Lord. And I was wrong. I was in the wrong. So God does that. He is my deliverer. He was Lowell's deliverer. And he could be your deliverer. And folks in this world, and I hate to be scary about it, but I think it's going to get worse. We're going to receive suffering. If you want to live, I can't remember the exact verse, but what did Paul say? If you want to live godly lives, you will suffer. Period. And we have to ask, are we willing to suffer for him? Is Yahweh your Elohim? Is Yahweh your God? I could tell you, though, he is worth it. His rewards are worth it. He, in fact, delivers even in death. Think about it. If someone kills us, they're doing us a favor. They're doing us a favor because we will be in the presence of the Lord. He is the vindicator. He is the one that makes things right. And not even death can change that. Let's spend some time in prayer just remembering. Maybe you just want to proclaim it. The Lord is my God. And I will praise him even if, fill in that blank. Maybe you want to pray, since you are my rock and my fortress, deliver me from, maybe you feel persecuted today. Or we could say what David says at the end of the Psalms, just encouraging one another, love the Lord, all you his saints. So if you'd like to pray out loud, please feel free to do so. But let's spend some time applying to thinking about praising the Lord for what we just read.
God, I want to thank you that you have and you continue to be my rock and my refuge and my protection. Mm-hmm. And I just want to give you praise for all the times that God, I have called out to you and I needed you to be God and you were faithful. And so thanks, and I want to give you praise for who you are. Mm-hmm. And that you continue Mm-hmm. As we call to you and as we ask, as we're in the middle of the trials that we face in this life, Lord, give us your comfort and your rest and your peace so that we can walk, even as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And sometimes those trials seem like that.
Lord, we pray for those brothers and sisters
yes.
overseas and countries where that is a reality of their life. Service members that we have overseas defending our country, we pray for them that they be strengthened, be witness to, and they come to know you.
God, you really are a rock and a fortress. And I thank you for the times that I've gone through those times where you've made that real in my life and heart. And Lord, I know there are more to come. And I want to declare it, even though all the evidence might point otherwise. I declare to the enemy of my soul, I declare to this world, I declare to my own flesh, that you are my rock and my fortress, and you will deliver me from any scheme, any spiritual force in high places that is doing things I'm completely unaware of. You are my deliverer, and I will praise you, even if I have to suffer for your name. And we pray this in the name of Christ. Will you say the third one with me? Kind of as an antiphonal kind of thing. You ready? Nice and loud. Love the Lord. Okay, we're not doing it.
It's not there.
Oh, can we put the last slide back, please? I'm sorry.
No, there's only two.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here it is. Love the Lord, all you his saints. You got that? Ready? Love the Lord, all you his saints. In fact, turn to the person next to one and say, love the Lord, you saint. Go ahead, do it right now. There you go. Very good. All right. Hey, thank you. Again, I hope if you're feeling discouraged today that this psalm, I encourage you to go back and read it. I have a few announcements for you as our worship team comes back. A few months ago, our friends over at Chicora Alliance Church did something called the Old Testament Walkthrough, and that was a way to kind of give a skeleton or just the general events and books of the Old Testament. Well, they're doing another one, and this one is the New Testament walkthrough. It is at March 8th, and we have it up here. The registration deadline, though, is next Sunday. And the way you register is, I don't know if you know Pastor Mark Wallace, but you can email him, markwallace@zoominternet.net, or text or call him at that number and say, hey, I want to come. And I want to, my spouse and I, whoever, or kids. The only kind of downside I see this is it's $20 a person. But you can ask. I don't know if they have things for families. It's great for kids and as well our grandkids. And you're going to learn the basic outline and format and events of the New Testament and how it all kind of fits together. And so it's very, very helpful. And so, again, we'll leave that up for you and encourage you to, by next Sunday, send a note to Pastor Mark. Trish and I will be there. We're looking forward to it. A couple other things with our kind of, I guess, is now our official donation table there. Next week is the deadline. If you have mentioned toothpaste, toothbrushes that you want George and Linda Beck to bring to Haiti, they're back there, but next Sunday's the deadline for that. I'll be handing all those off to them. Thank you for the donations that are already there. And then also it's the end of February that will end our 2-month span for Living in Liberty donations, and then we'll go to our next, I can't remember what's March and April, but it's up there as well, and the cards are up there if you need a reminder. So those two deadlines are coming as well. Speaking of Living in Liberty, I've been asked to speak. It's only about 10 minutes, but it should be about 900 guys. There is a one of these game dinners. It's a church in Butler, and they do an offering. And they said, we can't give you an amount, but we've given like usually around $5,000 to a group. Well, they've chosen Living in Liberty. And so I'll be there with another representative, and we'll be at a table that's part of their, vendor tables, I guess we would call them. And then they're giving me 10 minutes to speak to the group. And so be praying for that. It is this Saturday evening, that we'll be doing that. And then finally, one more thing. We, as a group of churches in the area, we meet for what we call our Lenten gatherings. They're on Wednesday night, and they start early March. Back there's some kind of fluorescent lime green schedules. It's at a different church every week. We're not doing one this year, but you'll see the churches and the speaker there. They're all at 7 p.m., and so I encourage you to grab that. Due to some other conflicts, I won't be able to be at all of them, but it will be whatever ones I can. So that's it. Let's continue worshiping.